Hello and welcome to Correspondence Report. I'm Elizabeth Jackson. Coming up in today's program, after 12 years, Matt Brown returns to Jakarta for the ABC and reflects on the changes. Sean Dorney tastes the delights of Kava Cola, a new low-energy drink. And World Cup soccer. South Africa says it's ready, but is it? Those stories coming up shortly. But first, an American investigative journalist is facing possible arrest and up to 6 years imprisonment in Indonesia after he alleged the Indonesian military was carrying out human rights abuses against civilian activists in Aceh and West Papua. Alan Nairn says he has evidence to support his allegations, which include criticism of Australia's support of the Indonesian military. I spoke to Alan Nairn late on Friday and asked him whether there'd been any development since Indonesia issued its threat to arrest him.
Well, yes. Initially, they made a general threat. Then I issued the challenge to them to arrest me so I could discuss their assassination program in open court. Then yesterday, the military spokespeople issued a statement saying that they intended to arrest me. There are contradictory news reports now. Some say that the charges have already been filed. Others say that they are in process. But the military says they do want to arrest me on the charge of tarnishing the good name of the Indonesian armed forces, of defiling the good name. That's a criminal charge that can carry up to 6 years.
So what are you doing? Are you trying to leave Indonesia now, or are you going to stand your ground?
No, I'm not leaving Indonesia. In fact, today I'm traveling to Jakarta, the capital, and I invite them to arrest me. If they really intend to back up their claim that my reporting on their assassination program is false, then they should bring me into open court.
Aren't you concerned that you might not get a fair hearing in Indonesia?
I think it's likely that I would not get a fair hearing. The Indonesian justice system is afraid of the TNI, afraid of the Indonesian armed forces. Generals have never gone to prison for the murders, even though this force has committed many hundreds of thousands of murders under the time they've been under U.S. tutelage, and also, by the way, been backed by the Australian military. Nonetheless, if they arrest me and bring me into court, there is the chance that in a formal legal proceeding, I will be able to speak.
But if you're not confident that you're going to get justice, why put yourself in that position? You could face up to 6 years imprisonment in Indonesia.
I don't know if that will happen or not, but I mean, whatever I face is minor compared to what the activists in Aceh have faced. A man named Tumi John, who was assassinated last year, he was snatched. His body was found in a sewage ditch. His throat had been slit. His body mutilated. He had been bound with electrical wire. Another one of the victims, Abu Karim, was sitting in his car with the window rolled down. A man walked up with a pistol and put two bullets in his head. So, you know, my problems are minor by comparison. And I want to expose the facts of this so the Indonesian public can see it.
What evidence do you have to support the allegations that the Indonesian military is presently carrying out human rights abuses?
Very detailed evidence. I begin by quoting a senior Indonesian official who describes the assassination program, names victims, names perpetrators, methods. In my article on my website, I list the names of several of the military hitmen. I interview General Sunarko, the Kopassus general. Sunarko acknowledged to me that his men were indeed involved in the killings, but he argued TNI military officers and men do assassinations. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the military as an institution doing it. I quote on the record the police chief of Aceh, who confirms that, yes, in fact, these men I named were secretly detained for their role in the assassination of Tumi John. So the documentation in my piece is quite detailed and extensive.
President Obama says He's seen significant improvement in human rights abuses in Indonesia in recent times. Is he wrong?
Yes, President Obama is wrong. These assassinations in Aceh that I detailed, the assassinations of civilian political activists, have occurred while Obama has been in the White House. They were run by an active duty general. They were authorized by higher-ups in Jakarta, according to the senior Indonesian official who first described this assassination program. And indeed, on the other end of the archipelago in West Papua, at this moment, the TNI, Indonesian Armed Forces, and COPASIS are also conducting terror operations against the West Papuans on an almost daily basis.
When the president visits Indonesia in June, he's expected to announce the resumption of aid to the Indonesian military, in particular the special forces known as COPASIS. If that goes ahead, what will it mean for Indonesians?
It will mean a green light for more terror. Indonesian generals and colonels who've spoken just in the past few days are gloating about the prospect of the aid resumption. They view it as their vindication.
Investigative journalist Alan Nairn, and if you're interested in his website, it's called Democracy Now! ABC reporter Matthew Brown has moved on from his posting in the Middle East and returned to Indonesia. It's been 12 years since he was last in Jakarta, and he's slowly getting reacquainted with his once familiar surroundings. I asked him to reflect on his experience so far.
When I flew into Jakarta late last month, I had a fresh impression of the city, but it wasn't a first impression. I'd been here back at the start of 1998, when Indonesia was reeling, in crisis, and the former general, Suharto, was about to fall after three decades in power. The hope in the air was all but stifled by dread. But in the end, hope won out, and today the contrast couldn't be clearer. There's an energy about the place, signs of economic growth and freedom that are truly inspiring. To old hands, I risk sounding naive, but I don't care, because I'm just so happy to be here. My last posting was in the Middle East. I made some lifelong friends, learned a lot, and grew a lot. But working in the field frequently meant talking to fools with automatic weapons, fearing bombs from the sky, or kidnap around the bend. Now, to be honest, the other day a young Muslim fundamentalist did lift my sunglasses during a visit to a religious boarding school in Aceh, but by and large, Indonesia is a much happier place. And so far, other reminders of my past life have been reassuring. I used to call Israel's Apache attack helicopters dragonflies, but the only dragonfly I've seen here was clinging to a cable outside our office window 16 floors above the street, and just as I was reminded of the airstrikes in Gaza, a thunderclap split the air, the wet season rain began bucketing down, and the dragonfly dashed away. In Indonesia, the military is still a big part of daily life, but it's withdrawn from an overt role in politics, and peaceful protesters are quick to press their case on the streets, railing against corruption or environmental destruction. There is a myriad of problems, but it's inspiring to see these people working through them with determination and a bit of cheek thrown in. For example, before I arrived, the Anti-Corruption Commission played phone taps featuring a top cop describing his force as a crocodile and the corruption busters as mere geckos. The public response? The recording became a popular ringtone around Jakarta, and anti-corruption campaigners quickly printed up T-shirts depicting each animal in this epic struggle for Indonesia's future. Since arriving, I've seen that there's also a struggle on for Indonesia's soul. The largest Islamic organisation, Nahdlatul Ulama, with tens of millions of members, is wrapping up its national convention, in which Islamic liberals were banned from running to lead it. And the High Court's just upheld an anti-pornography law that could be used to prosecute people doing such innocuous things as a traditional dance in Bali. Indonesia's a dazzling world of the mega-rich and the dirt poor, where people go to the mosque on Friday but won't stop at a tea house for fear of black magic. And it's one we know too little about in Australia. So in the evenings, I take a book and try and read up on a bit of Indonesian history. I sit out the back of my place where there's a small yard, and the bats flit past the frangipani in search of bugs, mosquitoes, I hope, and I'm reminded of just how lucky I am. You see, the Financial Review's correspondent Morgan Mellish lived here until he was killed in a Garuda plane crash in 2007. I'd known Morgan when he was in the press gallery in Canberra, and always admired his energy and his friendly manner. By the time of his death, I'd been in the Middle East more than 2 years. I'd seen plenty of killing, and come close myself a few times. But it was news of Morgan's death in Indonesia that really chilled me, made me feel my own mortality and reassess the risks of what we do when we leave Australia to follow the news. The bench on the porch has a plaque on it in memory of Morgan. And so, when I sit out there reading, I take a break sometimes, and I count each day that I get to witness this world as a blessing. This is Matt Brown in Jakarta for Correspondence Report.
Many of the US troops who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan have been seriously wounded. Faced with an often long rehabilitation, some are turning to an unusual healing method, ice hockey. Some of these army veterans have lost one or two legs, so they're using specially made sleds to tackle this tough sport. Our North America correspondent Kim Landers has been watching these wounded warriors in action.
Once a week, at an ice rink about 35 kilometres north of Washington, a group of very different players gets together. They're all army veterans, and they've all been wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. Many have lost a leg, some two, but they're all playing ice hockey. Daniel Camino is one of them.
IED hit my truck, utterly destroyed it, blew it way up in the air, flipped it a few times. Sad to say, it killed somebody in the truck, and then there was three wounded, myself, my gunner, my TC.
He was wounded in Afghanistan in August last year. It was his second tour there. He's got serious lower leg injuries.
As the truck was flying through the air, I wrapped my leg around something, some debris, which resulted in me breaking my leg, dislocating my knee, which tore all four ligaments in my knee, and then dislocated, fractured, and sprained my ankle.
But Daniel Camino is playing hockey by sitting on a sled. The frames are aluminium, the seats are plastic. They've got one, sometimes two, stainless steel blades. The sled players use shorter sticks, and they've got ice picks on the bottom to help with grip. Daniel Camino didn't skate before he was injured in Afghanistan, but he says it's pretty easy to pick up the basics of sled hockey.
But then to get beyond just going straight, it requires a lot of practice. You know, just simple things like turning and all. You know, you really have to get used to, you know, throwing your body weight around to do tight turns and all.
Not all of the 90 Army veterans taking part in the USA Warriors program are using sleds. Some, like Brett Gravelin, who served in Iraq, are skating.
I got titanium, a bunch of screws, and I've also got a machine that helps me turn my head to the left.
He skated when he was a kid, but he says returning to hockey now is helping him with post-traumatic stress disorder.
You know, everybody here's been through the same thing. Everyone's been over the wire every night. They've got some kind of injury. So it's a good group of guys.
And is it pretty competitive out there?
Yeah. I mean, everybody in the Army's competitive. So even though we're all broken and beaten up, it still gets a little rough.
Most of these veterans have been in the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. Some are still there. Drew Hill is one of the co-founders of this hockey program. He broke his back and neck when a mortar hit his helicopter.
We take away the military aspect of it, but we keep the team aspect of it. They know they're here on their own free time. They're allowed to do whatever they want, participate in drills, get better, and they just meet a bunch of group of friends, and they all play together, and they get strong together through everyone's injury.
And so, just for a minute, they get a chance to forget about what's happened to
them. Well, just like most of us, I talk to them, especially me, when I'm on the ice, I can skate and I feel no pain, I can move just as fast as I used to run, and everything's gone. You see someone next to you, and there's no injury. There's just another player who wants a puck harder than you and wants a goal.
Mark Little played hockey in high school and college, but he lost both his legs in Iraq when his convoy was hit by an IED. He's now got the challenge of learning to skate a different way.
It's interesting because my brain knows what it's supposed to look like and feel like, but my legs aren't doing it the same way. So it's a relearning process, just like relearning how to walk, relearning how to drive. Guys who are missing arms, relearning how to tie their shoes, same thing. I'm just the same power curve as all my brothers and sisters out here.
So what do you get out of coming out here and playing?
Well, so far, a lack of breath and a lot of sweat, but hopefully camaraderie with my brothers out here and some good hockey and maybe the ability to actually play one day, hopefully, if I keep working.
Almost 37,000 US troops have been injured in Iraq and Afghanistan, but here on the ice, just for a moment, some of them have a chance to forget.
It's a chance for us guys to get out of Walter Reed, to go do something fun and, you know, beat up each other on a little bit and have a group of guys that we're all close together with.
This is Kim Landers in Laurel, Maryland for Correspondence Report.
In Vanuatu, there's a new soft drink now on the market, Lava Cola. It's a cola drink with a kava additive. It produces the calming effect of kava without the muddy taste. Sean Dorney went to the factory on the outskirts of Port Vila to see the drink being made and to speak to the people who are hoping they can create a brand new international market. They'll advertise it as the alternative to high energy drink, the anti-energy drink.
Vanuatu kava is the most potent in the Pacific. It is definitely an acquired taste.
For those who aren't used to or don't like the taste or who are new to the taste of kava, it's a little intimidating and it's not pleasant.
Cameron McLeod is the marketing manager for a Vanuatu-based company called Unique Exports.
It's not wine. You don't drink it for its aroma or taste.
But now there is a new way to get the kava effect out of a soft drink bottle.
I developed a water-based kava extract about 18 months ago. No one's managed to do it previously.
James Armitage developed the product.
So we decided to approach Vanuatu Beverage and try it out primarily with the cola. The kava cola has turned out to be a really good hit locally.
James Armitage and his colleague Cameron McLeod have lived in Vanuatu for years and they witnessed the collapse of the country's kava export industry. Kava pills were banned by the European Union more than a decade ago because of side effects like liver damage, now attributed to former extraction methods where not only the kava root but also the stems of the plant were used in the manufacturing process.
The EU ban on kava really took the wind out of the local kava economy.
Cameron McLeod.
That's probably understating it. It really, really smashed it.
James Armitage claims his extraction method avoids the previous pitfalls.
Most people until now have been using alcohol extraction, and that's been the cause of liver problems, as you may know, in the past. It's just something that trial and error. I've been playing around with kava for 20 years. Just we hit it, found the holy grail, so to speak.
The future for kava is in a value-added product, and specifically one where you can taste kava and get the effect of kava without the muddy, horrible taste that's normally associated with it.
James Armitage claims the kava cola achieves that.
The taste is actually quite refreshing. There's no muddy taste. You don't want to spit afterwards, which is quite unusual. As you know yourself, you go to a kava bar and everybody's spitting. You don't have that feeling. You don't have the stomach bloating associated with drinking large volumes of kava. And four or five of these bottles of kava, and a lot of people are pretty zonked.
They are sourcing their kava from one island in Vanuatu, Maiwo. And the local Member of Parliament, Philip Bodoro, says the move into soft drink has been a real boon to his people.
People back home, like the communities, are very happy. They're very happy with what we are doing. And they can see the funds, the cash flowing back to the community.
A good friend of mine who I do drink kava with quite often explains it in that it's similar to a very mild liquid Valium.
There's a couple of other companies out there doing something similar. They're only using dried kava powder for their extract. They're not using anything nearly as potent as what we're using here, and we're hoping we can value add the kava here and produce it here and export the syrup to overseas. But the United States is a monster market.
In the short term, though, the next target markets for their kava soft drink, Lava Cola, are nearby Fiji and New Caledonia. This is Sean Dorney for Correspondence Report.
With less than 3 months to go until soccer's World Cup kicks off, South Africa claims it's ready. The country has proved many critics wrong by successfully undertaking a multi-billion dollar building program to host the football extravaganza. However, as our Africa correspondent Andrew Gagan reports, there are still some concerns about the event.
This is the sound that will greet players and fans at the World Cup. The vuvuzela is a plastic horn, and it's been sounding around South Africa as the country counts down the days until kickoff on June the 11th.
South Africa is excited about this World Cup because it is a great opportunity for us. Yeah. And we've been long willing to host the World Cup in our country. So we are proud of it.
Because this World Cup is for the Africans, you know?
Yes.
South Africa is definitely 100% behind the World Cup. Seriously, I mean, you just look around, you can see everybody's taken by the football fever.
When South Africa was chosen 6 years ago to host the tournament, it had to work hard to overcome doubts about its ability to stage such a massive event.
People are doubting and always hesitating, doubts. Can they do it? Can they not do it?
International Football Federation President Sepp Blatter.
There is no doubt, no doubt, and it is now on time for everybody, for the world of football. We have more than 1 billion people, they are directly or indirectly involved in the game. More than 1 billion. And they believe in Africa. So why? Still some doubtful questions? Let's go now. Let's have this World Cup. And then we will discuss end of July. Okay? Thank you.
But not everything is on track. Roads and hotels are still being built, while the stadium at Nelspruit, where Australia will play Serbia, has had its playing surface replanted three times. But perhaps the biggest concern for organisers, players and spectators is security. Reports in the foreign media of South Africa's alarming crime rate have been blamed for discouraging international spectators from attending the sporting spectacle, and ticket sales have been slow.
Foreigners have not snapped up the rather pricey deals on offer. South African tourism authorities say they expect some 500,000 foreign tourists during the tournament, but this figure flies in the face of evidence of below-par bookings.
The fear among organisers and many ordinary South Africans is that few foreigners will bother turning up.
FIFA itself has cancelled tens of thousands of rooms at South African hotels, so the local industry has been left with little choice but to either cut their prices or face empty establishments, which could potentially financially cripple them.
So when a report from the British Foreign Office was released this past week, which claimed that South Africa is a safer destination for British tourists than Germany, Spain and Thailand, the local press jumped on it.
Nearly 10 times more people died in Germany during the Soccer World Cup in 2006. Thailand is the least safest place. British tourists are most likely to die there and get arrested for drug offences.
South African tour operator Calvin Gilfellan has been going out of his way to reassure foreigners that the country is safe and ready.
There are some of the infrastructure that will not be ready for the World Cup, but I think the basic infrastructure will be there. And I'm sure that's the same in Polokwane, that's the same in Nelspruit, that's the same in PE. I think we are ready for this World Cup. I think people are underestimating this country. We transplanted the first heart in this country. We got the first people who got fuel out of coal. We will surely have a wonderful World Cup.
South African Deputy President Halema Motlanthe acknowledges that the country can't start partying just yet.
I think there's still more work to do. This countdown to the 11th of June, we need to ensure that when all these hundreds of thousands of spectators, when they land on our shores, we should be able to garner the necessary spirit of Ubuntu and embrace them.
Ubuntu, roughly translated, means I am what I am because of who we all are. Or put another way, humanity to others. And that's what South Africans want to show the rest of the world. This is Andrew Gagan in Johannesburg for Correspondence Report.
And that's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Elizabeth Jackson. My thanks to Jennifer Parsonage and Jess Hill. Join me at the same time next week for more thoughts and stories from the ABC's Foreign Correspondents.